Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What rights do protesters have while demonstrating, such as those involved in the protest against the acquittal of former St. Louis police officer Jason Stockley? There are constitutional protections, but how far do they go? Joining us to take a closer look is Jeffrey Mittman, the executive director of the ACLU Missouri. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, what rights do protesters have and how far do they go?
So the easiest guide to answer that question is the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, as well as a similar amendment in the Missouri Constitution. What we do know is protected is nonviolent protest, political speech. So, for instance, we can gather in public parks. We can gather on sidewalks outside of buildings. The protest can be loud. It can be noisy and raucous. It can be angry. What is not protected, what is not covered under speech, is criminal acts, burning cars, throwing rocks through windows. Those are not protected First Amendment activities.
What about the rights of police officers?
So this is an interesting issue. There's a few answers. One, in terms of their duty to the public, they are public servants who are required to protect and serve us. That's a tough job to do. I don't want to mince words. We demand a lot of them. It's difficult. It's normal that they will have human interactions. And in some ways, we say they can't exhibit those reactions. So I don't want to pretend it's simple. But here's the fact. They have a responsibility to protect and serve, and they have the ability to arrest, to detain, and take lives. That's why they have to meet a higher standard.
The other night, I'm sure you heard that the police were beating their chests and pronouncing the fact that the streets were theirs. What did you make of that? I mean, that seems to be on the line, perhaps.
Right. So there's a few answers. One, we know the best policing is policing that de-escalates, that stands its ground, that protects against criminal activity, but gives breathing room to protected First Amendment activity. We know that protesters are angry. That's why they're out there. So the more the police can do to give protesters the opportunity to lawfully and nonviolently express their anger, the better it is. In the context of Mike Brown and Ferguson and the history of mistreatment of African-American communities, to take a protester's chant, "Whose street's our street," and to throw it back in the faces of protesters is really ill-advised. You know, we wrote a letter to the mayor, and the mayor responded and acknowledged that. So we're looking at that issue.
Is there a difference between protesters and agitators?
So there's been some interesting reporting in local newspapers about the fact that even at the time of Ferguson, there were folks who were coming from outside the St. Louis community who intentionally were trying to incite violence. So there certainly is some reporting about that. And fortunately, this time around, it seems that the media really is doing coverage that says, by and large, the protests are peaceful. Most of the local protesters are gathering, are expressing their concerns, and abiding by the directions of the protest organizers. So I think that's what we want to focus on. A vast majority of the protesters are peaceful and nonviolent.
What kind of marks do you give the whole thing for how it's been handled so far?
You know, I'm going to step back just from the protest and say this. What we look at as the ACLU is, what do we want to achieve? What is constitutional liberty? What does St. Louis and our mayor and our community want to achieve? We want to achieve a community where everyone is treated fairly and policing is treated fairly. It seems that these protests continue to focus on that issue. They focus on the verdict and they focus on the context in which the verdict came down, where there's shooting of African Americans by police across the country. So it seems we are making slow, slow progress. That being said, we're nowhere near where we want to be.
How, when police are under attack, when missiles are thrown at them, how does that change things?
Right. So again, if the police are attacked, that is not protected First Amendment speech. In the Ferguson aftermath, the ACLU was in court and we got an order regarding the rights of the media because the media rights were being infringed. And that order said very specifically that as long as any bystander or media is not physically interfering with the police, they're protected. So even then, when the courts step in, they do recognize the difference between nonviolent political speech or appropriate media activity recording the activities of police versus physically interfering with the police.
Well, now that you've mentioned reporters, what about their role and their position in all of this? I notice in the Post-Dispatch today that the paper is protesting the fact that one of the reporters was arrested a couple of days ago.
Right. And that's very concerning. Again, what we look at from an advocacy perspective is what is the history? What do we see happening as a rule or as two not infrequent exceptions? So we have heard several reports. You've seen reporting. There have been online videos of reporters being interfered with, of their equipment being taken, of files being deleted, of bystanders who have an absolute right to a document. So the number of reports of police not respecting First Amendment rights to record activity is obviously very concerning.
And we look back at Ferguson, and there were a couple of incidents there that received a lot of attention and weren't resolved for many months.
That's correct. And unfortunately, here's what we tell people, and we would give the same advice to journalists as we would give to protesters. We know what the First Amendment rights are, and we recommend that you do assert them. However, if the police tell you that you have to give them the camera, or if they take away your files, or if they arrest you improperly, what we recommend is always follow the police directions, document what occurs, and then bring us the information so we can litigate afterwards.
We are talking with Jeffrey Mittman, who is the executive director of the ACLU Missouri. We'd like to encourage your calls. If you have questions about the legal aspect of these demonstrations taking place in St. Louis, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Or you can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. We have a caller I'll bring into the conversation right now. It's Kathy. She's calling from Webster Groves. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. My comment is that, you know, I think that the protesters should expect from police that they will be held to nonviolent, non-criminal behavior. They should not expect, when they're on the ground after being ordered onto the ground, to be sprayed with either mace or tear gas. I couldn't tell which from the video, like somebody in their basement spraying cockroaches with Raid. I think the police conduct has been abysmal. I totally, totally disagree and condemn any violence and destruction of property. The great majority of protesters have been very, very peaceful. I know some of them extremely well. And the police, seeing them on the news, marching in line down the street, beating their, I don't know what they call them, but their sticks in rhythm. And the whole tone of that was a bring it on kind of attitude.
Kathy, thank you. We have the point, I think, and we'll address that. And thank you so much for your call.
You know, I've seen those videos as well. You have individuals who are either lying down or sitting there in a group surrounded by police officers who are not threatening, they're not even speaking. Mm-hmm. And to see officers reach down and intentionally put chemical matter in their eyes, that's disturbing. I think what we want to say is our elected officials, our police leaders, need to investigate and need to establish clear policies.
When this sort of thing is happening, obviously it reflects a lack of training or disregarding training. Does the ACLU ever get involved in training police officers?
It's a great question, and here's one of the conversations we want to begin with the police and our elected officials. We believe the idea of collaborative policing, where the community, police, outside experts, advocacy organizations all come together and sit down and discuss and negotiate together the rules of engagement, to include training, to include how the community observes, how it's assessed, how they are assessed. That's the best practice. We think it's time for St. Louis to lead in that regard.
We should also point out, to be absolutely fair, that the vast majority of police officers do their job and do it well and do it responsibly. But you do have, as in any profession, you might have a bad apple from time to time.
Absolutely correct. And here's the interesting thing. There are many police leaders and fellow police officers who want the ability to single out the bad apples who are doing the bad acts. In the past, there's been a code against that. I think we're seeing that beginning to change, that good policing includes the opportunity to identify those who are acting improperly.
We have some calls coming in. I need to take a break before we start with that. But those who are waiting, please be patient. We'll be back very, very quickly. We're talking with Jeffrey Mittman, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Missouri. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Jeff Mittman. Jeff, one thing I did want to get to with regard to those people who are observing the demonstrations, if you will, are the legal observers. And people like yourself and people who work with you and for you are among those. What protections do they have?
Again, legal observers would fall under a similar category as reporters. They are there as watchdogs. And we know from our system of checks and balances to ensure the government works for us and works properly, we have the right to observe, to record, to document. Legal observers are trained in just that. They are there to see what happens, to be impartial witnesses, to provide information about what occurs. Unfortunately, again, we have seen and have reports that legal observers' rights to observe are not being adequately protected by the police. We'll continue to examine that.
All righty. Well, let's go back to the – well, how do the legal observers distinguish themselves? Do you wear an FBI-type jacket?
You'll see many of them have bright green neon hats that say legal observers, and they're usually standing in pairs, and they hold a small distance between themselves and the crowd.
Have there been any incidents involving these observers?
You know, again, as you know, there is so much going on. There are many reports. There are videos online. What we try to do is, as you noted, it takes a long time, but after the protests have occurred, we go through the evidence, we talk to witnesses, and if there are issues that need to be addressed, we address them in the long term.
How does one qualify as a legal observer if they're not with the ACLU?
Right. So the National Lawyers Guild has partnered with us for many years. They have trainings that very specifically tell the legal observers what they can and can't do, what their rights are, how to be good observers, and we invite people to go online, and we're always taking volunteers who can help us out.
What about law students?
Law students would make excellent observers. It's really exactly the right training, which is you were there not to influence what's happened, but to observe and document and provide acceptable evidence of what happens.
How do they get a green hat?
Again, if you go through the training, you will get that observer training. And for those who don't know, www.aclu-mo.org.
We will put a link to that website on ours at stlpublicradio.org. Back to the phones. We'll begin with Heather calling from Maryland Heights. Go ahead, Heather. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was calling because you were talking about what protesters can or cannot do lawfully, and I was wondering how does that apply to protesters who are blocking or disrupting traffic?
Okay, very important question. So here's an interesting distinction. We have what we call civil disobedience. So there is a way to engage in activity that is not violent or criminal but may not necessarily be legal. There may be rules against it. So, for instance, we're familiar with the idea of sit downs or lie downs or blocking traffic. And what you'll see is organized protesters who understand that they're subject to arrest and want to nonviolently make a stronger statement. While they are not necessarily protected from being charged with a crime, when you see it done in a way that is trained and managed by protest leaders, it's a way of heightening attention. Unfortunately, we see efforts around the country now to pass rules that would say it would be legal for a driver to harm a protester. We think that gets the balance wrong. A protester understands she or he may be subject to an arrest or charged with a crime, but they're willing to engage in that civil disobedience.
I wanted to bring this up because there are moves in a number of states, apparently, to develop anti-protesting laws. That, again, it would seem to me, is maybe preparing to step across a line.
I think you've got that exactly right. Yeah. Again, when somebody engages in civil disobedience, they get training on how do you get arrested, how do you get bailed, how are you giving information to somebody. So they know that they're breaking the law, but they're doing it in a nonviolent, creative, productive way to further a conversation, to then put them at harm's risk of being hit by a driver or run over or injured is really not a smart public policy move.
Is there any distinction between, let's say, a demonstration disrupting traffic on Olive Street and doing it on Highway 70, as has happened here more than once?
Really great question. And here's what the government can do. We have what are called reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. So public, nonviolent protest in the middle of Forest Park on a workday or a weekend, absolutely entitled to protection. Going down a residential street at 2 a.m. with speakers and foghorns and loud noises, that would probably be ruled not protected by the courts, not because it's not political speech, but because it would not be reasonable to disturb residents at home. So as long as it's viewpoint neutral, as long as the government isn't making decisions about what language or protest they like or dislike, they are able to impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions.
Let's take a call from Rich calling from the Bevo neighborhood. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, Don. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if what sort of role the referendum brought about by the previous mayoral administration to take the control of the police department away from the state and under the city, where we have a historically weak executive, plays in all this.
You know, so it's an interesting question. I think taking under local control, the police are part of our city. Generally, the police, again, like all elected officials, they work for us. And the more we have the ability as residents, as community members, to get the kind of government we want, that's really what democracy is about. I think what you see is a board of aldermen, community activists, organizations, police leaders, unions, and the mayor trying to work together to come up with a solution. I don't think any of us think it's fast enough or as far as we want, but for local control, the idea of democratic control of our system of government, that's what we want.
We have an email here from Madonna. Good question. Not counting violence or property destruction, how long are protesters held in jail? Are they typically charged with a crime or released without charge?
Right. So we have seen and heard some complaints that there are certain individuals who are not appropriately processed. That raises a whole nother large issue. We know that there are issues with our jail conditions. We know with there are issues with an insufficient number of public defenders to represent individuals. So that is a whole conversation we could have for a long time on another issue. But no, it is not sufficient, our processes for handling.
Another call. This is Bob. He's on a cell. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, I am very concerned about what's going on with regard to police overstepping their bounds. And part of my concern involves not just the individual officers who are the ones who are actually doing the incident, doing the illegal abuse of one kind or another, et cetera, but also the fact that there's other officers, generally speaking, around. Supposedly, I mean, you're talking about it only being a minority of officers who are the bad ones, so to speak. But what about all the good officers who are around who are witnessing this and not doing anything? That's a big part of what my concern is, and I'm wondering if the ACLU is doing anything to address that in a major way.
So, again, thanks for the question. Here's what we know from academic studies and individuals who work with and study the police. There has been a culture within police departments of trying to protect fellow officers. And I think you can understand why. Officers put their lives on the line. They can be harmed in the line of duty, and they need to know that they can depend upon the person to their left or right. I think what you see is a new policing effort by police leaders to train officers in the idea that, yes, you do protect each other, but that does not mean you protect bad acts. That's a big culture shift. I think what the best role for advocacy organizations and community members is to come together with the police and say, we need to fix this. We're not going to demonize you. We're not going to attack you. We're not going to assume you're out to do harm. We know there are some individuals who are, but we can't assume that the whole department is. How can we work with you to change that culture so that those individuals who engage in bad acts can be identified by their fellow officers without something being done against them?
We have a tweet from Maura who writes, in regards to officers spraying protesters, their badge number needs to be prominent on the uniform to properly adjudicate them. Is this going on here in our community?
Yes. Unfortunately, we've seen that both at the time of Ferguson protests and currently. We have seen instances where officers do remove or cover up their name tags. Again, in the letter we wrote to the city, we identified that issue to the mayor. And in the mayor's response, she identified that that was not an acceptable pattern. So that's something we're going to have to work with, to provide evidence, to work with the police leaders, and to ensure that the rules are clear. You cannot hide your identity.
The other issues that I wanted to get to concern today's technology. We now have drones, and we have all sorts of technology out there that can be used by both sides during demonstrations. What about that? What position can you take with regard to privacy and their use in demonstrations?
Right. So you've identified the two key civil liberties issues. One is, again, the police work for us, and we have a right to see and know everything they do. The ACLU recommends that all police vehicles and police individuals have cameras, that those are on during their official duty and they don't get turned off during interactions. Now, there are privacy issues and there needs to be protections, but those can be managed. We say that for good cops, the CAM will find what they're doing and document it, and that will be their best protection. For good defendants, same thing. For bad cops, it will document those bad acts. For bad defendants, it's a protection for the cops of bad behavior. So it's good to have that record. We think it should be through all police departments.
And I suppose with the photographers and videographers, we assume that they would be from the media perhaps. But if they're not, is there any special protection for them?
So again, the First Amendment makes very clear, and court cases have made very clear, individuals, even when they're being arrested themselves, have a right to document everything that happens between the police. So both the media and even bystanders are protected in taping, videotaping, audio taping, any police interaction. The police are there on the job for us. We have a right to know and see what they're doing.
And I know you have advice for people if they are taken into custody. There are some very specific things that they should do.
That's correct. Again, as a general rule, even if the police are giving you an unlawful order, follow the direction, do what you are told. As soon as you are able, take notes as to what happened, who was involved, what the occurrences were. Save those, send that to a trusted friend, or contact a lawyer.
Do you think there's any chance that the mere presence of police, or the fact that police can be brought into a situation quickly, can have a chilling effect on that basic First Amendment right to protest?
I think you the answer is, of course, absolutely yes. And here's the thing to remember. If we train our police officers, if we send the message that the police are there as part of our community, the community is not the enemy to be occupied or controlled. The community is the duty of the police to protect and serve. If we reorient to that solution, to that idea, we'll find that police presence will not be chilling. But unfortunately, yes, as currently is, when there's a destruction of equipment, when there's arrest of journalists, the police have become potentially chillers of First Amendment rights, and that's not okay.
One final call because our time is running out. Jay in Normandy joins us with a good question. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, I want to know about the, quote, peaceful demonstrators that were in the picture in the Post-Dispatch with a upheld AK-47 or AR-15, and the guy behind him looked like he was in Vietnam or Iraq presently with the same type of assault rifle. Are these guys supposedly peaceful demonstrators? The poor police officers that got to see that and deal with that, you know, that's as much peaceful as a nuclear bomb.
Thank you, Jay, for the call.
Yeah, so again, really important distinction. What the First Amendment protects and what the ACLU will always guard is nonviolent protest. As we said, it can be loud. It can be raucous. What is not covered by the First Amendment, you do not have a constitutional right to be violent, to destroy property, to harm others. That's not protected by the First Amendment and not what we do. And as we've said, as the reporting has shown, not an activity that most of or any large number of protesters are engaging in.
Of course, there's also a Second Amendment. In a lot of places, people can carry those weapons wherever they want.
Again, another show we could discuss. But as you said, there is a right to open carry, and that's something that people are talking about and looking at.
Yeah. We'll have to stop it right there. Jeff Mittman, thank you so much for being with us. Fascinating discussion. Learned a lot today. Thanks to you.
Thanks so much, Don. Appreciate it.
Jeff Mittman of the ACLU here in Missouri. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.